this way. I said, I'm not actually a very good writer, but my choices are very good. That's my strength. I find it not a problem to distance myself from the things that I write about. Whereas I think 20, 25 years ago, I would have felt a lot more involved in the characters that I was writing, because at that time, I wasn't really sure of how you defined the parameters of what one was writing. I didn't know how much of myself was supposed to be in there, or I was a real learner, and I found it very confusing. Now I like writing as a fictional author. I enjoy that. I'd like to write more prose, in fact.
Hi, and welcome back to Album with me, Arslan Mohammed, and you join us for part two of our Outside Spectacular. In this episode, which kicks off with A Small Plot of Land, Nick and I look at various aspects of this album, which came out in 1995, and still divide opinion amongst Bowie fans today, me not least. I hope you enjoy this conversation, and you know what? There's going to be part three. Yes, that's right, part three of the Outside Spectacular, coming, if not hot on the heels, then warm on the heels of this episode fairly soon. So I hope you enjoyed this one. Here we go. Following on from the Heart's Filthy Lesson, it's A Small Plot of Land.
Yeah, which again, like the Heart's Filthy Lesson, hails from the original Mantra sessions. Some of the tracks on the album have a sort of little designation, either on the in the liner notes, or sometimes they only appeared in the tour brochure, which had extra. But this is one of them that says it's to be sung by the residents of Oxford Town, New Jersey. So that's who's singing this song, for those who are interested. But yeah, this is certainly one of the challenging tracks, shall we say. It builds. It has this extraordinary sort of intensity. By the end, it's almost sort of shamanic. It just keeps on coming at you. We're very much in, possibly a little bit of Philip Glass territory. We, of course, right. Are someone that Bowie very much admired. But we're certainly in Scott Walker territory, which is someone else that Bowie heavily admired. I think this has bears quite a similarity to some of his. It actually sounds an awful lot like his album, bits of his album Tilt, but that's got to be a coincidence because Tilt didn't come out until after the sessions.
It came out pretty much a month after, didn't it?
Something like that, yeah. It came out. Certainly after this one had been recorded.
I remember hearing Tilt for the first time. I think I lasted 10 minutes.
Yeah, it's really uncompromising.
But of course, Bowie and Scott Walker, there was a massive amount of admiration flowing
both
from
directions.
Bowie, in both directions,
But certainly from Bowie, absolutely. He had a big history with Scott Walker. He loved his cover versions of Jacques Brel, of course, way back when, and he was a particular fan of the 1978 album Night Flights, which, of course, the title track of which Bowie had just recently covered on Black Tie, White Noise. Beautiful cover, actually, fabulous. One of my favourite tracks on Black Tie, White Noise. Fabulous. In this track, Small Plot of Land, he sings something about swings through the tunnels. That's practically it is a paraphrase of a line in Night Flights, isn't it, about and run the tunnels, what it did. It's a very similar line anyway. So there's that sort of echo going on there, isn't there? It's also full of Bowie's customary sort of spiritual angst, isn't it? There's a wonderful line in it where he sings, "Prayer can't travel so far these days."
That's one to add to the list of absolute zingers, Bowie and religion over the years.
It really is. You can pluck them out from everywhere. Sonically it's extraordinary. Mike Garson's going 19 to the dozen. Amazing drumming from Sterling Campbell. It's got this extraordinary sort of trick shot drumming going on. It's fantastic. What's it all about? Well, again, it's obviously the title, A Small Plot of Land, is a kind of, I think that gives us a very clear sort of image, doesn't it? Yeah. That's like sort of 6 feet of English soil or whatever that other, I think we're talking about a shallow grave. It's, again, the actual lyric is very impenetrable, very difficult to this push back the pigmen or something. It's just, it's crazy stuff. But again, we're cutting up, aren't we? They did quite a few different mixes of this, as indeed they did of all sorts of things, before Bowie decided this was the one he wanted on the album. It's a very, very different mix without the drums and just with those synth washes, which used in the film Basquiat, which came out the year later, which of course David Bowie played his old friend Andy Warhol. Yeah. Again, another part of Bowie's sort of mid-90s preoccupation with the art world, really, wasn't it? Because of course, not only was it a film about Jean-Michel Basquiat featuring the character of Andy Warhol, but it was directed by Julian Schnabel. live, he did a sort of unplugged, just him and Mike Garson on the piano, sort of almost just once or twice at a private function around about the time. And that, you know, that you can find those if you look hard enough on bootlegs and things. And that's great as well. So yeah, it's a great track. It's certainly one of the sort of...
It's tough going.
It is. It comes very early on and is a... I mean, I love it. I love all of this album, but I do, you know, this is one that I can imagine this being the point where someone might go, oh, okay, I've had enough, and switching it off if they're not really committed. But I mean, I think it's great. I think it's wonderful. I remember live, it was wonderful on that tour. It was a real, you know, it sounds it brought the house down or whatever, but no, it was really dramatic. It was really,
well, I can imagine it very stripped down, but just piano and Bowie and those bizarre impenetrable lyrics.
Yes,
and just the mood it must have created.
Yeah,
it's one of those atmospheric pieces.
Yeah,
which I mean, I'm guessing he didn't play it in the context of other songs from the album. So,
no, the tour wasn't it wasn't one of those ones where they do the whole album and then they do some encores. There were new songs and old songs all mixed up. He did kind of follow through with the whole idea of I'm not going to sell out.
Yeah.
So yes, he was doing oldies, but he wasn't doing Let's Dance. You know, I think the sort of most golden oldie type ones he was doing. He did Moon Age Daydream, Boys Keep Swinging, which is a known song, but not exactly, you know, for most people, not one of his most. And he did DJ. The only time he ever did DJ on tour was on the Outside tour. He also took some quite well-known old ones, but totally changed them. He did this kind of trip-hop version of The Man Who Sold the World.
Yes, I have that.
And he did a weird kind of electro, grungy, don't even know how to describe it version of Andy Warhol, which was amazing, the kind of slap bass going on and things. It was quite extraordinary.
That? The Man Who Sold the World, I remember buying a 7-inch single. I think it was Strangers When We Met.
Yeah, it was. They did a studio version of the sort of weird Man Who Sold the World version, which became a B-side later.
Very
on. Yeah,
minimalist.
Right. Yeah.
Sort of, I think it's slightly drum and bass.
Yeah. And interestingly enough, that version of it was used as the basis for when The Man Who Sold the World was sung in the musical Lazarus, Bowie's last piece of work. That was the version that they did. That
the
they did that sort of strange blippy, you know,
version.
Really
works though. It works really well. Yeah. I mean, it's very, very haunting and entrancing.
Yeah.
That version, just minimal.
Yeah.
So small.
So anyway, that was the tour. Yeah. No, sorry. other thing to say about it as well. Again, just one yet another example of this whole fact that this album and Bowie were kind of enmeshed in the world of British art at the time.
Yeah.
In 1996, the year after Outside, the wonderful Andrew Graham Dixon, who I admire massively, did a wonderful series called A History of British Art, which was a kind of revisionist series. Mm. It was very importantly called A History of British Art.
A History,
It wasn't I'm Kenneth Clark, this is Kenneth Clark, Civilization. It was quite a revisionist series, and instrumental opening track bit of A Small Plot of Land was the title music for that series. Bowie's track, A Small Plot of Land, for that. Yeah, and that was great. Again, it just felt like, he's part of this whole world, which was really wonderful. He was genuinely a fan of things. You know, he wasn't. It wasn't a pose. It wasn't a sort of I'm, you know, some multimillionaire rock star who swans in. As you say, it wasn't that. He was genuinely interested, and if he hadn't been genuinely interested, he wouldn't have bothered. You know, he would have got involved, but he was, and he did. And he wrote. He went and interviewed painters for Modern Painters magazine, and got terribly excited about it. About going off to, you know, he was basically sent off on commission to interview. You know, people like, I think Jeff Koons, for example, and people like that. And you know, he was genuinely fascinated in talking to other artists about their
work,
creative process, and their work. Yeah. And he never stopped being fascinated.
Well, it was sheer yearning, that constant craving for new information, to be fed data, to be fed new ideas, to be stimulated.
Right.
And I think without that, you can look at maybe points in his career where perhaps that wasn't so evident. And consequently, his own output suffered as a result.
That's exactly right.
It's fascinating. And so that's harks back to what I was saying earlier about, even in the video for Heart's Filthy Lesson, when there's a sort of exuberance in the cutting, the editing is a perfect example of that. The confidence to be able to do that.
Yeah.
You need to have supreme confidence. And as we said earlier, Bowie is completely invested in Outside. So no matter superficially how ridiculous and over the top it sounds, he is there.
He
believes in it, which of course is the hallmark of any great artist or any great work of art. Is the artist's complete investment and inhabiting that artwork. So that's a very pretentious way of saying that. But he was well mad for it.
Yeah, he was.
As we said in the 90s. Mad for it. Absolutely mad for it. So The Small Plot of Land has, well, it's segues.
Yeah, the first of these spoken segues. Yes. This is Baby Grace, a horrid cassette, isn't it?
Yeah.
So this is Bowie playing the first of several parts that he plays in this thing. And so this is the 14-year-old murder victim. Mm-hmm. And again, you know, we're treading this fine line between the absurd and the sinister, because, you know, it is David Bowie with his voice treated by a vocoder or something, sort of sounding like a little girl like that, and talking about popular musics and aftershocks. It could so easily be just preposterous, and it sort of is, but there's something so, as you've said, it's so, he's so committed to it that you just go with it, and it's kind of amazing.
It's great. To me, I thought of the Clockwork Orange film and Burgess and things
like
that. There was something of that about it, in the delivery or in the general feel of it. But definitely, his. I mean, on Black Star, he goes back there again. What's it called?
Yes, but Nadsat.
This really had a Burgess feel to it.
Yes, yes.
As we get into the narrative. So that's the first segue.
I mean, it is. I think one of the things, in a way, that pulls it back from being just comically daft is how bleak and horrible it actually is. The fact that it is subtitled A Horrid Cassette puts into your mind, does it not, the idea that these, whoever it is who's murdered her, has recorded her.
Exactly.
And of course, that is going to take your mind in the direction of the Moors murders and things like that, which is, obviously, we're suddenly in not funny at all territory. And
I did assume that a gumshoe detective prowling around the dark streets of some apocalyptic city. I hadn't made that Moors murders connection, to be honest, and that is a sobering reflection to make. Obviously,
I don't know whether that was in Bowie's mind.
When you're aware of the fact that notoriously the murderers did record their actions, and they are, from all accounts, pretty much unlistenable.
So that's lightened the tone, hasn't it? This is part of this album's dark majesty, if you like, that underneath what superficially is very often seems bonkers, there is something really quite dark and really quite horrible. It is a very unpleasant album. It's a very unwholesome...
concept album about murder.
Absolutely. About murder and about murder as art, as we said, which is in itself going quite... So, yeah, it's, and again, that puts it off a piece, doesn't it, with these other works of art of the period that we're talking about. It absolutely... This is Bowie's... This is the piece of art that Bowie produced at the same time that Damien Hirst was producing Bisected Cows, and the same time that those sort of films that we've talked about were coming out, which, you know, I think Seven is an amazing film, and it's not Seven's fault that what ended up happening was sort of torture porn and those sort of films, because they're not the same thing at all. For the first time in however many years, Bowie does seem to have produced an album that taps into the zeitgeist at every level, you know, like he used to back in the golden days of, you know...
It was in the air. At that point, wasn't it? Yeah. It wasn't, there was even the ironic postmodern splattergore of Tarantino's films.
There's
a slightly cynical assumption that we had become inured to blood and guts and gore. You go back to YBAs, again, people like Matt Collishaw at the time, of the bullet wound in the head.
Yes.
We were being given these things in the context of art, entertainment.
Actually, there's the notorious Murray Hindley portrait, isn't
there? Yes, of course.
There's a connection I hadn't made before, because I just mentioned it. When was it? Was that at the same time?
Yeah. All these things were happening at a time when death, gore, murder, everything was sort of more or less up for grabs. In a sort of moral, we had a moral choice to make.
Yes.
The work was presented there.
Yes.
Now, on the more esoteric and richly textured end of that spectrum, we had people like Lynch, Bowie with One Outside, where these narratives were being presented to us in form in things like Twin Peaks and, you know, Lynch's movies, and then something like this. Do we sort of sit back and say, wow, that was a very satisfying murder mystery story, a la Hercule Poirot, or... No, the more disturbing element.
Exactly, that's the difference, isn't it? Now, look, because I like an episode of Inspector Morse as much as the next chap, but this is something totally different, isn't it?
Yes,
it's not
exactly.
It's not.
I think that's what I was rather clumsily trying to get to.
It is very interesting. You know, the historian Lucy Worsley, who does lots of documents, she did a fantastic series and book about this very subject, about the way that culture has invented and reinvented murder. You know, how you know, way back when you'd have penny dreadfuls and the way that the Jack the Ripper murders were reported and things like that, and then going on into the 20th century and we get it to sort of Agatha Christie and things like this. And it's fascinating the way, you know, the way that we culturally cope with something as horrible as murder is constantly evolving. So I guess this is sort of, you know, it's a contribution, isn't it, to that sort of thing? Because as we've been saying, this is the kind of way of coping with something so horrible that was the way that the discourse was presenting itself in the mid-90s.
Definitely, even now, when you just said the name of the little segue, Baby Grace, A Horrid Is it Horrid Cassette?
A Horrid Cassette.
A Horrid Cassette sounds very much like it's from a Penny Dreadful, doesn't it?
Yeah.
No, like a chapter heading, a Horrid Cassette or a Horrid Letter or something. Okay, well, we move on to the what I reckon is probably the big hit.
From the album, I mean, I guess this
in its reinvented form.
This is the one that people who don't know outside probably do know. Hello, Space Boy. Yes, reinvented as a hit. Maybe we'll come to that in a minute, or should we come to that straight away? I don't know.
No, not really. I think it kind of moves. It literally moves us out of the dark nighttime of Oxford Town.
Yeah,
and takes us back to a place which even the most casual of Bowie fans will be very familiar with.
Yes. You know, that's right.
Outer space.
Of course, we got the space thing. Well, it is interesting, isn't it? Because I think the album track version is really very different from the Pet Shop Boys remix, which is what was released as the third single from Outside in the spring of 96 or the February or so of 96. Maybe we should talk about the single version first, because it kind of is interesting the way it kind of reflects back. Yes, the album version is a pretty uncompromising wall of industrial sound, and it's great. It's got a great tune, and it's a great... You know,
but it's incredibly heavy.
Very powerful, very heavy. And yes, and Bowie did approach the Pet Shop Boys and ask them to remix it, and they, you know, put a sort of... a very disco. They Pet Shop Boysed it up, basically, didn't they? And very successfully so. And Neil Tennant, of course, came in and sang those patches of lyrics from Space Oddity, which is kind of outrageous, actually. It sort of, in a way, goes against the ethos of this album, doesn't it? To sort of take possibly Bowie's most famous greatest hit and inject it into this album. And apparently, when they first came up with the idea, Neil and Chris were in the studio doing it, and Bowie phoned up to say, how's it going? Or whatever. And Neil said, we're just putting in some bits of lines from Space Oddity with me singing them. And Neil Tennant said, he told this story later, he said that there was a kind of long pause on the phone, and then Bowie said, I think I better come over. But anyway, they got their way. And
I'm
it
on my way down.
I'll be right down. Yeah. But no, they got their way, and it went out. And it is rather glorious, isn't it? And it's got that kind of pulsing disco-y. But it doesn't actually lose the sort of menace of it. It's just a much more spangly, poppy, charty sort of thing. And indeed, it did well. It went to number 12 in the UK.
I remember seeing it on the Brits.
Bowie and... The Boys performed it live at the Brit Awards in 1996, the same night, of course, as the legendary Jarvis Cocker and Michael Jackson incident. I mean, now there was a Brit Awards
moment.
That was a moment, yeah. But yeah, great performance that they did there. And then they did it on Top of the Pops a couple of weeks later as well. And there's a great video that David Mallet, Bowie's veteran video director, did. A wonderful video, which is part sort of performance, it's got Bowie and the Pet Shop Boys appearing in it in sort of spotlights and things, but it's also got this wonderful sort of cut up. It's very of a piece with the Brian Gysin Burroughs Bowie thing. It's kind of cut up montagey images of boys and girls and spaceships and things that are in the lyrics.
It's very Brian Gysin, isn't it?
Yeah.
I mean, like you've got the cut, like you're saying, all these elements there. Then the line that Neil brings to the fore, let moon dust will follow you.
Will
cover you.
Yes, if I fall, moon dust will cover me.
But
moon dust will cover you is in the song. But yeah, absolutely. It's very, the whole thing is very Brian Gysin. Going back to the album version, the original, absolutely. What a racket. A wonderful racket. But if that had been released as a single, who knows? It might have. But this was, it's very Nine Inch Nails, isn't it? It's quite industrial. A bit Pixies.
Mm-hmm.
Maybe even
a little top spin of Pixies there.
A little top spin of Pixies. A bit of early Cure, maybe? Sort of pornography era, maybe? This was a period when Bowie was... I never quite know how much he was into The Cure, how much of their stuff he listened to, but every now and then in Bowie's late work, I hear a bit that I think, that is so Cure-y.
I guess he would have liked it. I mean, obviously, the other way around, I mean, Robert Smith did Quicksand.
Of course, Robert Smith was a huge fan of Bowie. And
that's an interesting point. I don't know how much... To what extent Bowie was a fan of The Cure, who liked them.
And so, of course, these things can be totally coincidental. Yeah. I mean, I did ask, actually, Tim Lefebvre, the bass player on Black Star, who plays this wonderful... doesn't even sound like bass, it sounds like guitar, but it's not. It's him playing it very high at the very beginning of Lazarus, in the opening, the intro to that. To my ears, that sounded so like an old Cure song called Pictures of You.
It is,
I did ask him about that, and he said, no, I don't think so, coincidental. But who knows whether Bowie... I don't know, but yeah.
In fact, that's, yes, that, I'm hearing both of them right now, and they are very, very similar.
But anyway, these things may just be coincidences. So anyway, getting back to Hello With You, that was the Cure digression. but it was kind of, you know, this was just at the point that, you know, Robert Smith did sing at his 50th anniversary thing a couple of years later, and I like that connection. I hope it's kind of there. Maybe even Smashing Pumpkins, because of course they did actually have a song called Space Boy a couple of years earlier, so that may or may not be a coincidence too. But again, like Outside, this is a song that grew as a kind of a hybridized thing that grew out of various sources. It was developed from an instrumental that initially Reeves Gabrels put together, Montreux, during the initial, not the very early sessions, I think it was during a later session in 94 when he'd come back to do some dubs, just him and Bowie, and he sort of put this thing together and Bowie quite liked it, and then it was kind of forgotten about, but then heavily reworked in those New York sessions at the beginning of 95. So it sort of had this quite long gestation period. The album version, which is the version that Bowie stuck to when he did it live later on, and it, by the way, was, I think, certainly it was the most heavily performed live song after the Outside tour. He kept it on, and in nearly every tour he did after that, it was a highlight. It was a big number, you know. And he stuck to the album version when he did it live. And there's something, you know, it's not just an absolute racket of guitars and drums. There is a sort of a wonderful, so this almost goes a bit jazzy in the middle. There's a bit where Garson plays these wonderful sort of piano runs, and I don't know if I'm hearing some saxophones there or something, but there's something quite.
I know what you mean about the jazzy thing. Those lovely skittering little piano riffs and things that go on, and it's such a contrast to the slamming, the heavy drums.
I
love that texture that goes on in there.
It's wonderful. And the you know, one of the recurring lines in it, of course, is "This chaos is killing me," which again is just, that's
you
could write that across the front of the album. it's one of the kind of key, and also it harks back, I think, to older Bowie tracks in so many, you know, there's always echoes, aren't there? In Baby Universal, which is the opening track of Tin Machine 2, which was one of the really very good Tin Machine tracks, I think. That's got the, he sings "Hello Humans" in the chorus of that, and he says "Hello Humans, Hello Space Boy." There's kind of, you know, kind of hearing a bit of
that's
similar
a
there.
Very good point. There's definitely, I think, "Hello Space Boy" and "Baby Universal" are definitely related.
Yeah, they're definitely related.
They're definitely related.
And I'll tell you another relation that I think is there, is on many years later, on "The Next Day," there's a song called "Love Is Lost." One of the great. Now it's slower. And it's quieter, and it's also, but the actual chord sequence and the actual thing, it's "The Darkest Hour, You're 22. It's very similar to the "Space Boy, You're Speaking." And then it's got this sort of da-da-da-da thing in it, which is again very similar to a little guitar figure that Reeves plays in this. I think that, you know, they're sort of close relations too. Very different.
That's a second cousin quite removed.
Yeah, it's a second cousin, but yeah.
What do you think of the Space Boy theme? Because obviously, like you said, Bowie is very conscious and aware of himself in this album. He knows how he's coming across. He's not oblivious to this. And of course, he knows then the trope that's always trotted out about Bowie, about, you know, Space Oddity, Moon Age, all the rest of it. Do you think there's a conscious toying of, you know, a playful referencing of that going on?
I mean, it's, you know, to a certain extent, of course, it is just, you know, he was always interested in space and stuff, and about outer space as a sort of, we've talked about this before, I'm sure, haven't we, as a kind of a metaphor for inner space, if you like. So it's not just about I'm interested in planets and spaceships and alien worlds. It's not just that. It's about the sort of existential issues that come out of, you know, obviously he was a big fan of, you know, Tarkovsky and all those sort of films in 2001, and, you know. So there's all of that going on, but there is also, as you say, I'm sure by this stage in his career, there is also the simple fact that he's dangling another one in front of us, another space boy.
Yes,
you know, it's almost become, for Bowie, it's become a sort of found object. You know, a sort of symbol that we already know. You know, it's a familiar one. I mean, he did it again on Black Star, didn't he? In the video of Black Star,
he's
putting in things that are sort of little references for us to notice.
The astronaut suit.
As usual with this, I'm not quite sure what he's getting at, really, with the whole Hello Space Boy thing, in terms of the, you know, if we're going to try and connect that to the narrative, but I don't think we should. I don't think we should try too hard to work out. Because that's, as I've said many times before as well, that's not the point, is it? There isn't a...
That way madness lies.
That way madness lies. And it's not a cryptic crossword. It really is not a cryptic crossword with a correct solution. You'll be trying to work it out forever.
That is the key to approaching this album, is not to try and do that, because that's where I've fallen down in the past. I've tried to approach this album and parse it and uncover it and learn how it all works. And of course, you know, that's why I'm not so familiar with it. It's just that it's failed. But then, like I said, when listening to it in preparation for our podcast today, and just looking at the songs one by one, they are really, really bloody good songs.
They're really strong. It's really strong material on here,
And then you start to see, just from the corners, you start to see the commonalities they have and the possible themes they have. And that's rather a really nice way of doing it. It's just to let it come at you rather than sort of like, I've got to understand this. Got to know what's going on.
No, just let it in.
So, The Motel.
Yes.
Next up, The Motel. Now, this really reminds me of Bring Me the Head of the Disco King.
Yeah, Bring Me the Disco King from...
Bring Me the Head of the Disco King.
Well, there's an interesting Freudian slip, isn't
there? Why do I think it's called Bring Me the Head of the Disco King?
Well, probably because we're talking about all this murder.
Murders, dismembered bodies.
Interesting. You're right. It does have a... It's reminiscent of that, isn't it? I think it's one of those ones that echoes and pre-echoes of other Bowie things, but I think that's because it's I think for Bowie himself this is an influential song on his own subsequent work, because I mean, to me, this is a highlight, possibly the highlight of the album, and you know, I said earlier on, The Heart's Filthy Lesson is a personal favourite of mine. I think by any standards this is honestly one of the all-time great Bowie tracks for me. I think this might be in my, you know, I don't do favourites, but this might be in my top 10.
For a man who doesn't do favourites, you have an awful lot of favourites.
Well, that's why I don't do favourites, because I've got too many.
It's just pointless.
But no, this is a real high. I know it's one of Mike Garson's favourite tracks he ever did with Bowie as well.
Well, he's very prominent on this.
And he is, absolutely. But it's a fantastic piece. It's a very nuanced, very measured piece. It's very stately. Yeah, Mike Garson's doing this very sort of ornate, almost the sort of Lady Grinning Soul type thing, that very sort of romantic 19th century.
Very cinematic
sort of, almost. Yeah, and the song, melodically, and it's a kind of slow burner. It takes forever to get going, and then finally explodes into this very cathartic sort of play out. In the way that later tracks do, like Sunday on Heathen.
Yes.
Or it's also got maybe a flavour of Slip Away, the later song as well. It's got that sort of...
I can definitely see Sunday.
Yeah.
I don't know about Slip Away.
It's a darker song. It's a very dark song, of course. And again, The Motel, this is one of the settings of the thing. But of course, again, we're talking about sort of found cultural objects, aren't we? If we're talking about small town murders in America and you bring in the word motel, then obviously we're going to think about Psycho, aren't we? So that's something that, again, I think just is there to sort of be plucked out of the air. This is To Be Sung by Leon Blank, by the way. His surname is Blank, or is it? I suppose that's a kind of John Doe sort of thing, isn't it? But this is him singing this. So it's got that kind of small plot of land thing again, I suppose, going on with the motel. There is no hell like an old hell. That's a line to conjure with, isn't it? That's amazing. And there's this wonderful thing as the chords progress, he gets just this wonderful thing and he sings it, and it's Lights Out, Boys. That's an amazing line as well, which makes me think of Sweet Thing a little bit. You know, if you want it, boys, get it here. It's pretty obviously reminiscent of Scott Walker's track The Electrician from that album Night Flights from 78. Obviously a track that Bowie loved. He referenced it even more heavily, one might even say blatantly, on the track called Heat at the end of The Next Day. The Electrician is a very, very dark number. People have argued about what it's exactly about, but it's probably about someone who electrocutes people, whether he's an executioner of the electric chair or whether he's a sort of torturer in some South American Republic, something like that. That's what it's about.
And there's definitely a very strong line from that to this whole album.
Definitely. So yes, it's a beautiful song. He sings it beautifully, but it's got this wonderful sort of toe of menace about it. You know, he loved playing it live as well. Mm. It was one of his favourite ones to perform live. And other than Hello Space Boy, which I mentioned a moment ago, I think this is actually the one that had the longest sort of live shelf life afterwards. He was still playing it on the reality tour, and it was always a showstopper.
Yeah.
A fantastic number live. And interestingly, he, on the Outside tour, the tour that, you know, obviously this album went out originally, he started off in America with a slightly different order, but by the time he'd got to the UK and Europe, The Motel was usually the opening number of the...
Really?
Which is an interesting one,
yes,
isn't it?
Yes.
So you'd have the support
Clearly
act.
Clearly an important song for him. Yeah.
Yeah, absolutely. So yeah, Morrissey was still on when I saw the tour a couple of times, because he famously, of course, disappeared halfway through the tour. But anyway, so we had Morrissey, and then he went off, and then they, you know, did the refit and everything, and the band came on and everything, and the first thing they started playing is, if you can imagine, these sort of slow, weeping chords from the beginning of The Motel, and then gradually you know, no hurry about it, Bowie sort of appeared from behind a drape in the table and just came on singing. And it was, in its own way, just as theatrical an entrance as one of his big coming down on a rope from a giant spider in a way. There was something so... he was sort of just dragging his feet, almost in a Ziggy-ish sort of way, in that very mimetic Lindsay Kemby sort of way, across and, you know, wearing his kind of painter's overalls, and, you know, rather than opening with Rebel Rebel or something, you know.
Well, I think it just indicates the importance of this song too.
Yeah, really. Yeah.
You know, I mean, giving it that prime position at the beginning of the show. I mean, I know you don't do favourites, but you said this is definitely one of your non-favourites.
Yeah.
But do you think this is, in a way, sort of the heart of the album, the blackened heart of the album?
I think it. I mean, you know, you could make that claim for a few of them, but I think it sort of is. Yeah, yeah.
Given its position in the track
listing, it's sort of like the centre of gravity.
It's the centre of gravity. Exactly.
Yeah, it is. Yeah. Although this is, I mean, this is a very long album. It is Bowie's longest album by a mile. It's 75 minutes long. And this is probably why this is going to be a 75 part podcast. Although it's a long album, it's a long album with many tracks. Most of the tracks aren't unusually long, but this is certainly among the longer ones, isn't it?
Seven minutes.
I think it's probably the longest track, isn't it? Yeah. 6 minutes, yeah. Something or other. But it's certainly, it takes its time, and that's part of its power. It's got this sort of, it's like a fuse that's been lit, and it's gradually, slowly burning along. And I think it's terrific.
We were talking about motels, and you mentioned Bates Motel, and then you also, earlier on when we were chatting, you mentioned Beats as well. And do you think there's a sort of beat sensibility to this?
To this track?
Yes.
The album at large, I can see a lot of sort of the Burroughs type influence and that sort of thing, and the guys. Yeah, I think there probably is to this track, as much as to any of them. I mean, couldn't you put a reading on it that's something from On the Road, you know, that we've stopped off at some motel somewhere. The whole album, to me, does absolutely harks back to Bowie's interest, which goes back, you know, to his young days. I mean, his half-brother introduced him to the Beat Poets and to Kerouac and all that sort of stuff. And I think certainly on an album like this, I'm hearing a lot of that. It's quite an American album, isn't it?
It is an American album, and we'll come to that with the narration of Nathan Adler himself, which is you know, the archetypal LA gumshoe noir kind of character. Just before we leave the motel, as it were, you mentioned the electrician. Bowie never covered the electrician, whereas he covered Night Flights, which was another, obviously, a key Scott Walker tune, which meant a lot to him. Whereas this could be almost an interpretation of the electrician in a sense. It's certainly got a bit of that. Because I went back and sat through the electrician for the sake of this podcast.
Yeah, isn't it? Exactly. Yeah.
And I can certainly see parallels in mood, in form, in that sense of dread and the sort of mystery.
Yes.
At the heart of it, that you don't quite know what's going on. Like you say, it's quite ambiguous.
Yeah.
Something very nasty is happening.
Yeah, yeah.
But you don't know what it is, do you, Mr. Jones?
Very good. And I think this is something that Bowie, I mean, he was always wise to it from the word go, but it's certainly something that he had in common with Scott Walker with this sort of songwriting, is that it's far better, far more sinister and intriguing not to put all your cards down on the table and explain the whole thing. It's far better to just give us enough to intrigue and slightly worry us, but then that's it, that's all we're getting.
If only Lynch had directed a Scott Walker video. Did they ever collaborate?
I'm not aware that they did, but if anyone would like to write in and correct us, I don't think so. He certainly didn't direct a Bowie video, although of course Bowie did appear in the Twin Peaks film, as we've said, but
that would have been an interesting collaboration. Lynch, Scott Walker and David Bowie. And in fact, what was that film that Scott Walker soundtracked shortly before he died? It was a really creepy film about a little kid who may or may not grow up to be a fascist totalitarian dictator.
Oh, I don't know this.
It looked great.
Sounds amazing.
Yeah. He did the soundtrack for that.
Right.
It was called The Leader or something like that.
Please. He's been acting out of it.
That's only a little boy. He didn't actually hurt anyone, did he?
I'm sorry, Mama.
Why would you want to hurt anyone?
Do you like it here?
Why don't you lead us in a prayer, my love?
No. Hold your hand up.
Tu es en colère contre quelqu'un?
Wouldn't you like to make some friends?
He's spying on us.
Have you been to Oxford Town?
I have been to Oxford Town, England, but I haven't been to Oxford Town, New Jersey, because it's fictional, as we have already established.
You're quite right, because I have not been to Oxford Town in either. Yeah, I've never been to Oxford Town in England, nor the fictional one in New Jersey.
Interesting.
New Jersey. Yeah.
Oh, that's interesting. Yeah.
It's one of those things that seems to have slid by me, like going to Scotland or you know, going skiing. I just haven't done it yet. So I have not been to Oxford Town. Is the next track here?
Yes, it
What do you make of this one?
It's another one I love. I think it's, I mean, I don't know how anyone could not love this because it's so catchy and so, I mean, absolutely from the second set of sessions, this one. This is from
the pop sessions.
January, the pop sessions, if you will. I think it is probably the catchiest number on the album.
Yeah, it is.
It's got this wonderful little bouncy bass riff and it's got Carlos Alomar instantly recognisable doing those wonderfully funky little frills on rhythm guitar. But I love that sequencing. Yeah. It's so
darkness.
He keeps pulling the rug from under you, doesn't he, basically. And it was done very quickly, this song, apparently. It began life, Eno mentions it in his diary in considerable detail in the book that's published, so we know quite a lot about this one. It began life with the title Trio on the 17th of January, 95, there you go. And Bowie added the vocals just a couple of days later, and according to Eno, he did it in quite a weird way, a very Berlin way. He said, right, I think I've got it, I'll need five tracks. And he went in and first pass, he just did the odd line here, the odd line there, and left long gaps and just words and things. And then he went back and then did the next bit. And by the time he'd done five passes, it was all there. But
he
layered it up in the wrong order, sort of in a random order, which is rather fantastic.
That's so cool, isn't it?
Brilliant. Very bad. I mean, you hear stories about him doing something, not exactly that, but similar sort of things when they were recording tracks like Joe the Lion on Heroes. And at that stage, it was called Toll the Bell, which, of course, is a line in the chorus. And then they changed it to Have Not Been to Oxford Town. I suppose Oxford, it's an interesting choice of name, isn't it? Because it is obviously a real name of a real place.
Yeah.
Obviously. And of course, as I mentioned, Inspector Morse a while ago, it is a place associated with murders, I suppose, in that sort of pop cultural way with Inspector Morse. I don't know if that's a thing. Never really thought about that before.
Do you think Bowie was a Morse fan?
I don't know. He might have been. He did love his crime shows.
He was
a huge fan of Peaky Blinders and things like that. I mean, it's obviously got a more obvious sort of narrative than most of the songs. This is clearly Leon sitting in his cell saying the prison priests are decent, my attorney seems sincere, he's on debt. So this is interesting. Unusual subsection of Bowie songs for you. It's a small subsection, but it's there. The Death Row Bowie song.
Right.
Very early on, in his teenage years, he wrote a song called Bars of the County Jail, which is about a boy waiting for... And then, of course, we have the Wild-Eyed Boy from Free Cloud. We have The Next Day later on, which is a song, you know... So, I mean, I don't think there's anything to be made of that, but it's interesting.
Well, I'm very glad that you acknowledge and define the little subsect of Bowie songs, the Death Row Death Row playlist.
It's interesting, isn't it, that there are little... You know, there are so many of these. You can pick them out all over the place. The Venn diagram of Bowie songs is a massive... You know, someone could do an amazing mural of that one of these days. But that is a... It's interesting that he would return to these little scenarios in different ways and under totally different sets of circumstances. And again, of course, we've got the pre-millennial angst. We've, you know, 20th century dies is a line that keeps coming up in it. So again, we're talking about this, you know, toll the bell, pay the private eye, all's well, 20th century dies. It's sort of jolly and bleak at the same time, isn't it? It's a bit like We'll Get By, I suppose.
Fantastic
Voyage.
I also thought of 25 Minutes to Go by Johnny Cash for some reason.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
You know, it has that sort of mix of dread and humour.
Yeah, that's right. Also, another thing I love about this track, and quite unusually on this album, is it starts and ends. Eno was always a big fan of fade in and fade out. And Bowie has often done that. And quite a lot of tracks on this album do that. And you know, sometimes tracks fade out when I would really like them to end with a bang. And of course they did live. When Bowie did Hello Spaceboy live, of course when you do a song live, you have to end it, don't you? And he would always end on a final, moon dust will cover you. End. And it would just have this massive, you know, and the crowd would go wild. Wonderful. I'm always slightly disappointed that it just fades out on the album. This song just has this wonderful end.
Yes.
It has a little bit of Carlos doing his little twinkly there, and then it just kind of goes and stops, and it's a rather wonderful, wonderful ending. Oh, another fun fact. Unusual Bowie cover versions we have known. Quite quick on the mark after this, there's a cover version by Zoe Polidorus on the soundtrack of Starship Troopers, the film by Paul Verhoeven. Which is, of course, set in the future. And it's at the big party that all the graduates have when they've just left Starship Trooper school or whatever it is that they've done.
I must confess I haven't seen the film.
I really like the film. There are schools of thought about this film, and indeed about the novel that it's based on. Mm-hmm. It's Robert Heinlein, isn't it?
Oh, is it Robert Heinlein?
Yeah, it's a Robert Heinlein novel, but I don't know how... I haven't read it, so I don't know how different the film is. I only know the film, oh dear. But, no, I know there are schools of thought about this. It's either a deeply biting critique of sort of fascist, militarist Western states, or it is just a fascist militarist fantasy, depending on your take on it. I can see the satire. I think it's as every bit as satirical as RoboCop. You know,
I think this. Well, not having seen it, but I would agree, because I think Paul Verhoeven is.
Yeah.
He is somebody who also has a pretty dark sense of humour.
Yes. And he's also somebody who, like Bowie, doesn't sort of take you by the scruff of the neck and have you got it yet? He leaves it to you to be intelligent enough to get what the thing is. So I think, anyway, I'm going for the satirical thing. But yes, in the film, there's a sort of band playing it at their sort of graduation ball. And of course, it's changed. The lyrics are changed. It's "I Have Not Been to Paradise," she sings. And they change it to the 25th century dies or whatever it is, because obviously they're in the future. But is there? That's really weird. Sadly, it wasn't on the soundtrack album, though. I think there was a kind of a deluxe version came out a while ago, which did have it on. But it's a really quite a nice version, actually. Mm-hmm. So there we are. Yes. I mean, great track. Again, it was great live on the tour. It was only done on that one tour.
I really wish I'd seen that tour. I mean, and there is no official recording of that tour.
There's a few bits and bobs of TV appearances of the odd number here and there, but no, there isn't an official album of it. I keep going on about it, but it was a terrific tour. Carlos went out on that tour as well, so he was there doing his guitar and everything.
Well, we're recording this at the end of June 2019, and so this year we've already had Loving the Alien, the box set, come out.
Yes.
Now, I'm hoping that... Now, the next one could either be the Tin Machine box set,
mm-hmm.
or it could be, Black Tie and Buddha and this.
Into this, yes. I don't know. I'm not sure what the plans are. Well, I'm not sure. I have no idea at all what the plans are for going on from here, whether there's going to be a Tin Machine one on its own or whether...
But what a strange box that would be.
Yeah.
Black Tie... suburban outside.
Yeah. Well, so we shall have to wait and see. Great number, though. Great number. I think it's an early. If you're listening to the album, I think it's one that leaps out at you early on.
If it was up to me to choose the singles from One Outside, I think this definitely would have been a single.
Oh, sure. Yeah.
No Control. Next track.
Yeah. This is another wonderful one. And another, as I said earlier on, I think it could have been in a different universe. Could have been another contender for a single, because it's very. It's quite commercial. It's got a fabulous sort of dark electro disco, sort of Euro disco almost groove, hasn't it? A little bit Pet Shop Boys, a bit sort of Chemical Brothers-ish maybe. Actually reminds me a bit of Paul Hardcastle 19. Yeah. It's got that sort of boom, boom, boom bass line. It's a little bit similar, but this is way darker. apparently recorded very, very quickly. Again, Eno's diary gives us this. Recorded on the 20th of January, 1995, mm-hmm. and according to Eno, pretty much finished in an hour.
Oh, which is amazing. In 1 hour?
Yeah. Which is pretty incredible, really, isn't it?
Start to finish, that is amazing.
Yeah. Now, I don't know if that includes the vocal, but the vocal, God, Bowie sings this so beautifully. I mean, we've talked a lot before about what a supreme vocal sort of stylist he is, how he can change his vocal to fit a particular song. And on this, it's extraordinary. I mean, you know, the verses he's singing in a very soft sort of way, very close to the mic. And then he gets to the... I don't know if you can even call them the choruses, the sort of bits that happen later on. and he suddenly kind of stands back from the mic and sort of opens his throat in this very sort of heroic sort of... it's just beautiful. I think it's a fantastic number. And the lyric is pure double-distilled Bowie. It taps into the Bowie motherlode from every direction, this song. I mean, for a start, again, we've got this kind of sci-fi millennial angst, you know, the troubled spirituality. Stay away from the future. He says, "Sit tight in your corner. Don't tell God your plans." That's an amazing line. I mean, it reminds you of Sound and Vision, of those sort of songs about, you know, I'm going to lock myself up in my room. But it's also almost this kind of Dickensian idea. You know, Charles Dickens has this thing, doesn't he? His characters construct a protective cocoon for themselves that. And all it does is it becomes their prison, you know, Miss Havisham.
They become trapped by their safety.
Martin Chuzzlewit and things like that. Yeah, and it's got that feel to it. This kind of I'm all clutched up here and I'm not going to, you know, I'm not coming out. But don't tell God your plans. And then in the later on, he sings, "You've got to have a scheme. You've got to have a plan." This fear of being sort of out of control and not having a plan, that seems to be a long-standing Bowie motif. Of course, one of the last songs he wrote was called No Plan. And this control is, and again, it's an ongoing preoccupation with Bowie. The idea of losing control or surrendering control seems to be a constant. It goes right back to the beginning. I think it has to do with a sense that he occasionally did confess to in interviews. There's an interview he did around about Scary Monsters time, big long interview he did in his dressing room for The Elephant Man, I think, where he talks about this in some detail, that the sense that as an artist he found it occasionally difficult to shake off this sort of ball and chain of white English middle classness. Again, almost that Kenneth Clark Civilization thing, you know, that sort of framework of what it means to be a European artist, because the idea of relinquishing control is actually, you know, fundamentally quite terrifying. But it might not be about that. You know, we might be talking about control over one's creativity as an artist, or it might be control over your surroundings, or it might just be about control over yourself, you know, drugs, whatever, or emotions, or a relationship with God, or whatever it might be. But you see these kinds of equal and opposite forces pulling at Bowie in his lyrics, right through his career, this anxiety about giving up control. So, you know, on the one hand, Gene Genie, let yourself go.
Yeah.
But on the other hand, oh no, not me, I never lost control.
Control,
and hanging over it all, of course, is Ground Control to Major Tom. You know, it is fascinating that this... And so here we have this song, No Control. He also, by the way, he mentions in it, he brings up the phrase bloody robes, which is a line from Teenage Wildlife, that the midwives to history put on their bloody robes. And suddenly we're... And interestingly, on top of that, this little bit of self-plagiarism, as it were, I don't know if that put him in mind of the song Teenage Wildlife or if he was just thinking of it anyway, because on the Outside Tour, another oldie of quite obscure nature that he had never played live before, which he pulled out, was Teenage Wildlife. Unlikely Bowie cover versions number two, believe it or not, No Control was actually included in the SpongeBob SquarePants musical, which opened in 2016.
Now, that's an obvious choice. When the makers of SpongeBob SquarePants were looking around for music, they first alighted on Outside.
Kind of amazing, isn't it? I mean, different lyrics, I'm told. Yeah. I haven't actually, I'm afraid, had the pleasure of seeing the SpongeBob. Have you ever seen SpongeBob
SquarePants? I haven't seen it. I do know that he, didn't he narrate?
He did an episode. He played a character.
He played
a
character.
Yeah. I mean, you know, we're both... old. No, God, I thought I'd seen some weird stuff when I was growing up. I grew up with Noah and Nelly, for goodness sake. What could be stranger? But no, SpongeBob.
What's Noah and Nelly?
Well, okay.
Are you sure that was a children's programme?
Yeah. Noah and Nelly on Skylark. Don't you remember that? It was done by by Bob Godfrey, who did Rhubarb and Custard, and then later did Henry's Cat. I can't believe we're having this conversation.
Rhubarb and Custard.
Yeah,
yes.
Everyone remembers
Henry's
that
Cat.
One.
I know, yeah.
Well... Noah and Nelly was in between. All aboard the Skylark. Does that not ring any bells at all?
Not at all.
Do you think we ought to get back to... No, SpongeBob SquarePants. No, I dutifully watched the Bowie episode of it, of course, and I'd never seen SpongeBob SquarePants before.
It.
Yeah, well, I thought I've got to, you know. And I sort of quite enjoyed it, but my God, what a weird load of... crikey. Anyway, there we go. It was great. Bowie loved watching it, of course, with his daughter, and that's why he...
That's what he said, wasn't it?
My
daughter Lexi, she was the one.
Yeah. He was great. It was a wonderful... performance. Right. He's throwing himself into that as well. I mean, just great. And he's a little, obviously it's animated, so he's this little creature. He's the king of Atlantis or something.
Yes.
And they've actually given him mismatched eyes, like Bowie, you know, in the cartoon. So that's absolutely brilliant.
I am the Lord Royal Highness, but my friends call me LRH.
My friends call me SpongeBob.
Art is what happens when you learn to dream. Go ahead, dream a little.
I remember when we spoke... way back when about Space Oddity, and you brought up the notion of time as a recurring motif in the, and now again control. I mean, isn't it amazing how these, from Ground Control to No Plan, how this has overarched his songwriting career.
It's a fascinating little neurosis, isn't it? That we all have, I think. You know, that there is. It's a fundamental. We fundamentally like to believe that we're in control of our lives, and that we, you know, that we've got it all mapped out. But, you know, as John Lennon famously said, life's what happens to you when you're busy making other plans. It's obviously something that Bowie thought was worth confronting, you know, coming back to in his songs, with one of our coping mechanisms for the horror of how chaotic life actually is to pretend that it has a structure that it doesn't have, to sort of create patterns. And this is, I guess this is what this control and plan thing is all about, really, isn't it?
That's what you were saying earlier about the millennium. The millennium is a man-made construct.
Yes.
In order to try and impose some sort of coherence and some sort of structure onto the fluid nothingness of everything.
Yes. Yeah.
And I'm sure he was very aware of that. And the impending millennium, we were panicking what this new series of numerals in our lives would mean.
Yeah.
And
but, you know, almost were we frightened? That was the scariest thing of all, actually, that it was meaningless. And it's a great track. It's a dance floor, you know.
Well, you just summed it up much better than that. And it's a great track.
But both of those things together make it even more brilliant for me. You know, that it's a really quite profound piece of philosophy, and it's quite disturbing, I think. But it's also, it's a banging tune.
It's a banging tune indeed. Do you think if the record label hadn't exerted that pressure on him to go back and record, I mean, do you think that it would have been, do you think it actually has made it better?
I don't know. Better's difficult to. It's sort of hard to say, isn't it? And also, I don't think we should run away with the idea that Bowie was reluctantly recording some pop tunes. You know, so all right, if you insist, this is what. Yeah, I don't think it was. It wasn't like that. He was aware that the thing he'd done was obviously too extreme for the companies to want to record, to want to release. Fair enough. But I don't think we should be thinking of him in these second set of sessions, kind of, you know. Sort of sitting there all grumpy because he's got to put a tune on it. You know, I don't think it was like that. And of course, as we know, Bowie was forever evolving his musical, you know, what he was interested in from one moment to another. And this was months after the first set of sessions. And of course, you know, he's kind of got, you know, his next work is already on the horizon. So it's always a sort of evolving thing, isn't it? I don't think it would necessarily have been better or worse. It would just have been different, wouldn't it? I mean, I think, you know, the album that we ended up with here is so intriguing, and I think the fact that it was born of this sort of fractured sort of double session actually in a way is the making of it, because it does create something even more chaotic than would otherwise have been the case, you know, and that's so in keeping with what he's on about that it, you know, and it gave us some banging tunes, so yeah. So if it was a winner, it's a win-win.